Happy New Year, everybody. Coming today on the show, we will talk with John Word of the Baton Rouge Advocate about the year in movies and music. And we lost some prominent people in the entertainment world in 2012. We'll discuss some of those who passed away in the past year with John Word, and much more. LSU, by the way, losing its finale of the 2012 season on the last day of the year in Atlanta, falling to Clemson 25-24. More on that. And David Bellinger, better known as Elwood in Atlanta, a prominent caller to talk shows for at least two decades, a man who has made a difference in some ways. We'll talk with him. All this, now the news from National Public Radio. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our numbers are 877-217-5757 and locally 297-5633. You may reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. In a moment, John Word from the Baton Rouge Advocate. But last night in Atlanta in the Chick-fil-A Bowl at the Georgia Dome, LSU lost 25-24. Field goal as time expired from Clemson as LSU finishes season number 8 under Leslie Edwin Miles with a record of 10-3. LSU was outgained last night 445-219. This comes on the heels of last year's BCS title game in which Alabama outgained the Tigers 384-92. So in the last two postseason efforts, LSU 307 yards, Alabama and Clemson 829 yards. Are the days of LSU's status as an elite power fading? That will be the developing story through the summer months as Les Miles prepares for year number 9. And we will follow it right here on WRKF and on this show. It was quite a year in movies and music, and the man who follows them closer than anybody else in this community is John Word. Quite a year for him as well. 20 years now at the Baton Rouge Advocate. Hello, John.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me today. It's been 2 years since my last confession. I have not been here in 2 years.
Has it been
2 years? Almost exactly to the day.
Wow. I didn't realize it had been. That's too long. But 20 years at the Advocate, did you get some kind of special acknowledgement?
They give out what they call service pins. And you know what? I was so busy that day, I completely forgot about the ceremony. They have a ceremony.
Really?
Somebody presides?
Does Carl Redman get in a robe? And
I wasn't there. I was working.
Well, that's what you do.
And I got distracted, and I got involved in my work, and I forgot to go to that thing.
Okay. Well, we're glad you're here to start 2013, and John goes to any venue that has entertainment of note in this community and follows all types of musicians and singers, locally and otherwise. In 2012, who were some of the bright lights on the stage in Baton Rouge?
Well, I want to mention that I saw Jim Inkster at a concert recently.
I do go Roseanne, out occasionally.
Roseanne Cash, you were there with another one of your celebrity friends.
About 100 of our closest friends. That's a very interesting venue for someone of the stature of Roseanne Cash to be playing. But as far as the acoustics and the atmosphere, she really looked like she liked that venue.
Performers, I think, like an intimate venue where they can really be there with the people close to them, and they benefit from that. I think they pull energy from that. A lot of them say that sort of thing, at least.
And the venue we're talking about?
The Red Dragon Listening Room, which is an unconventional venue that he operates that has sort of almost a charitable organization. Mm-hmm. I think all the money goes, or most of the money goes to the performers, and he does it, apparently he really does it for love. We're talking about Chris Maxwell.
Yeah, and it was quite a night with Roseanne Cash, even though, as I said, maybe a few more than 100 people were there.
I would say 100 people. It could be as many as, well, I don't want to get him in trouble. Could be as many as 120, I don't know.
I don't think they're supposed to get more than about 120 in that place, but it was packed, and the acoustics are spectacular. And Roseanne Cash chose to perform there on her way to New Orleans. The next night she was at Tipitina's, I believe.
Which the capacity is 1,000. Yeah, from what I read, it's 1,000.
But she didn't go through the motions. She gave it her best shot, and it's pretty good. And her husband, that guy,
John Leventhal.
Yeah, he is a remarkable musician in his own right.
He's her producer and her co-writer, and I think they've been married since maybe 1993 or something like that. Mm-hmm.
The daughter of Johnny Cash, who was preceded by the son of of Hank Williams that night.
Or so we've heard.
Martin Flanagan. We've heard that on this show.
Yeah, he's been a guest here.
Yes, and it was Martin who enabled me to be among the movers and shakers, such as John Word, at that event. Would you rank that as one of the top in the year? If
Oh, yeah. One of the top shows in Baton Rouge that only 100 or so people saw.
What are some of the others?
You know, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival was really spectacular this year. It was a lot of older acts, but the number of older iconic acts was just unbelievable. The reunited Beach Boys on the third show of their reunion tour. Now, a few of the Beach Boys have passed away, but three of the principal, and maybe even four if you count David Marks, I think his name is. He was in the group very early, and he dropped out. Of the genuine Beach Boys, and Bruce Johnson's been in the band since 1965 or so I think he deserves credit too. It was a nice show. It was a nice show they did. Brian Wilson is the genius, the musical genius behind the Beach Boys in so many ways. And he's not a performer. He's like some of these other great people behind the scenes, like a Phil Spector. Phil Spector wasn't known as a performer. Brian Wilson is not a performer. He might try a bit to be a performer, but he's really not. But it was just great to have him there. And singing, and he might have hit a few off-key notes, but it's marvelous to see Mike Love, Al Jardine, and Brian Wilson, the three of them. And these are the three real Beach Boy guys on stage. And the musicians they work with are incredible, and they back the original guys up so well. So that was, for me, that was a real treat, even though the Jazz Fest people actually saw an abbreviated version of the concert that the Beach Boys took around the whole world.
Did you see Arlo Guthrie when he came through Baton Rouge back in February?
You know, believe it or not, for whatever reason, I did not.
He put on two very good shows.
He was at the Manship Theater, right?
He was, which is one of the fine venues of any kind. Another intimate place, 325 seats. And because of that, it limits the kinds of people who will appear there because the gate is not going to be heavy because of the seating. But Arlo Guthrie, who lost his wife this year, on the 100th year of his father's, since his father's birth, Arlo put on quite a show, and he is now 65 years old.
You were there.
I was there twice.
Okay.
Twice. And then ran into Arlo at the Hilton, and we had a nice discussion.
Oh, good. What did you talk about?
Actually, Arlo wanted to talk about the Lord.
The Lord? Oh, he's...
He's
born-again Christian or something
well,
to that effect?
Well, he's a Christian, and I guess by virtue of that, he's born again. But that's what he wanted to talk about.
Uh-huh. You don't hear the born-again phrase too much. Maybe it's fallen out of fashion.
Well, we'd get into a long religious discussion here, so we'll just leave it at that. But Arlo, the reason we talked a lot about the Lord was because there was an Episcopal ministers' convention at the Hilton at the same time, and a rather intoxicated minister was accosting Arlo Guthrie, and I interceded, and Arlo asked me to sit down, and we had a nice conversation.
You were a lifesaver.
I wouldn't say that, but it was a surreal evening with Arlo. But who else? 2012.
Well, if I can go back to the Jazz Fest for a minute, you know, the Jazz Fest is every year, I think maybe they're going to be in their 43rd year, something to that effect, this next year, this year, 2013, as of today. But they had Bruce Springsteen, who's been there before. They had Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. They had the Eagles, Al Green. Just giant groups.
So next year, I'm sure many of these types of performers will come back. They get all kinds of musicians there other than jazz people. It's developed into something far beyond a jazz festival, hasn't it?
For many, many years, it's been something far beyond a jazz fest. Well, from the beginning, they had Professor Long, from early, at least early years, they had Professor Longhair, for instance, who's an R&B. Professor Longhair is somebody actually beyond description. Are you familiar with his work very much? He's one of the legends of New Orleans piano and, and the songs like Big Chief, which is a Mardi Gras favorite. So he was there early on and very important to it when it was much, much smaller than it is now.
All right, 297-5633 if you'd like to visit with John Wirt. Now 20 years writing about movies, music, and other matters for the Baton Rouge Advocate. A listener asked about the Bayou Country Superfest. I did not go this year. Did you?
Yes, I'm going every year. You know, that's part of my job to cover it.
That's
the festival.
Probably not your kind of music, but
I don't like to say that I like any particular kind of music because it's my job to cover as much as I can, and the whole spectrum of music. And I really do appreciate the whole spectrum of music. And a guy like Keith Urban, who's been at the Bayou Country Superfest multiple times, he's a great artist. I wouldn't deny it. And Jason Aldean is so popular. He was there this past year. He's been there multiple times too, I think. They really are top tier acts.
Well, this year we lost some top tier acts, including Whitney Houston, died at 49. She was an amazing performer, and 48 years old when she died, almost 49. But the way she died was tragic.
It reminded me a lot of the Michael Jackson situation, and they died right about the same age. And they were stars at the same time. A lot of parallels, I think. Yeah, that's a great tragedy whenever you lose a wonderful artist like a Michael Jackson or a Whitney Houston or an Elvis Presley, and on and on and on, and it happens so often. And I just spoke to a wonderful R&B soul artist from Detroit named Kim, and Kim was a co-star with Whitney Houston in her final movie, this movie called Sparkle that came out in August of last year now. And Kim talked about working with her, and he didn't actually have any scenes with her, but he talked about how everyone on the set of Sparkle were just so impressed by her. And one of the phrases he used, "We wanted her to win," and I think that was a reference to her problems with substance abuse and personal problems. He said, "We wanted her to win," and I think that was a beautiful expression that he used. And I spoke to a gospel artist earlier this year who worked on the set of The Preacher's Wife. The Preacher's Wife was her 1994 movie, Whitney Houston and Denzel Washington. And he talked about how he had been on the set because he worked in music. He was he's a gospel singer and producer and that sort of thing, and he saw Whitney performing one of the songs in the movie The Preacher's Wife, and he told me that people were so knocked out, they were so moved, that they had to close the set down for the day because no one could carry on. That's how powerful Whitney Houston was in her prime.
I think as we hit the break, we'll hear a little Whitney Houston as Richard Fisher plays one of her top hits, early Whitney Houston, circa 1985, I think.
That's when many people first saw her for the first time.
And as we hit the break, hopefully we'll hear her splendid voice.
A long instrumental introduction. Here you go. No, I'm still wrong.
When we come back, we'll hear Whitney. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. John Word of the Advocate is with us on the first day of 2013. Richard, before we talk about other people of 2012 who passed away, I think we've got to hear Whitney's voice. Whitney Houston. She could take a pop song and bring life to it like no one else. And a couple of big shots who used to introduce the likes of Whitney Houston died in 2012. Dick Clark and Don Cornelius, two DCs. What do you think?
Yeah, those are both major figures. And in many ways, Dick Clark made it possible for Don Cornelius to come along and have his own absolute entertainment dynasty that he created with Soul Train. They were both really great broadcast personalities. And Jim, you're a broadcast personality, of course. You must admire them and all they accomplished.
Sure, I do. And they accomplished it on a grand level. In fact, you know, American Bandstand, when you and I were very, very young, it was an afternoon show, and then they only had three networks, so Dick Clark was the most recognized face in America for many, many years. Andy Williams, he died, 84 years old.
Wait, Andy Williams, the singer, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
84 years old, and he was a staple on television for decades, and of course was synonymous with Christmas, and Andy Williams was gone at 84, and at 86 this year, Andy Griffith passed away, and he, of course, was the greatest comedy star of his time in the early 1960s, Andy Griffith, and this music is one that will stick with us the rest of the day, I'm sure. John is smiling.
Whatever happened to Ernest T. Bass? That's what I want to know.
Ernest Howard Morris, wasn't it? That was the actor?
Yeah, one of those great character actors who would show up on The Griffith Show.
Yeah, and George Lindsay, 83, who played Goober. He died this year as well.
Did you ever meet George? Because George would go around to hardware stores and things and work in... be the celebrity there to promote the opening of the hardware store or whatever. He would do those kind of things.
I never met George Lindsay.
Okay, I got you. I got you. You've talked to a billion people over your time as an interviewer, but I met George and interviewed him for the Richmond Times-Dispatch approximately 1984 or something like that. Now, I never got close to Andy Griffith, unfortunately, but I wonder if you saw... if you have Turner Classic Movies, every year Turner Classic Movies does a montage of the actors and directors and screenwriters and I think on into cinematographers who passed away in the year. And they open their montage with Andy, and it's a great, memorable image of Andy, probably from his early film.
He never won an Emmy for his show that...
That's crazy.
Carried his name, but Don Knotts won several.
Mm-hmm.
And the other day, this past weekend, I was in Los Angeles at Westwood Memorial Cemetery, and I took a photo of the gravesite of Don Knotts, and it says Don Knotts, 1924 to 2006. He saw the poignancy in people's pride and pain and turned it into something hilarious and endearing. That's a good
Don Knotts had great success after the Andy Show, but obviously... he will always be the deputy.
Barney Fife.
Deputy Barney Fife on Andy.
James Carville's hero. 297-5633. Scott in St. Francisville. Good morning. You're on with John Wirt. Hi, Scott.
John. Hi, Jim and John. I have a dear friend I've known for decades, and he follows all this stuff with Andy Griffith pretty closely. And he said that... they only made about four or five episodes with Howard Morris as Ernest T. Bass, and they quit him they stopped having him because they had so many letters and everything. It was going to become the Ernest T. Bass Show.
See, there you go.
They just dropped him. He was a regular player on the Sid Caesar Show.
Okay. Now, that was before I was, I think before I was born, actually. But, yeah, I could.
Jim might have been, I know when Jim was born, so he's out of it, too. They had Carl Reiner, Sid Caesar, and Howard Morris. I think that was the limit. And they had a lady player for each of them who would play their wives in skits.
Okay. Classic show from television's, a lot of people call that television's golden age.
Also gone in 2012, Larry Hagman, 81 years old. Remember him as Tony Nelson on I Dream of Jeannie?
That's where I first saw him, yeah.
And he also was J.R. Ewing in Dallas in that episode in November of 1980. It attracted 83 million viewers. I saw
good numbers, Jim.
I saw Mary Crosby, Bing's daughter, shoot Larry Hagman, son of Mary Martin. But he found life on the small screen enduring, lasting from the 60s almost to the present. Larry Hagman, who had a full life, including a liver transplant. Jack Klugman, 90 years old, died a few days ago.
Right.
Oscar Madison, one of the great characters in television history, which started as a character in a movie with Walter Matthau, who's buried a few feet away from Don Knotts, by the way.
I've been to Los Angeles once or twice, but I never got to the Cemetery of the Stars.
I like looking at the epitaphs, and Dean Martin says, "Everybody loves somebody."
That's what his stone says?
That's what it says.
That's great stuff.
That's what it says. And Merv Griffin says, "I will not be right back after this message."
Oh, no.
Yeah. Now, the Oscars for 2013 could feature a Louisiana entry, The Beast of the Southern Wild.
Beast of the Southern Wild is made by a New Orleans director, a small independent film, a grassroots sort of company down there. And they have ambitions for doing lots of good work in the future. And I talked to the director. They had a press day in New Orleans at one of the Grand Hotels down there. And I talked to the director. I'm very, very impressed with him. And it's a movie that I think they hope would take off and be more commercial success than it was. It didn't really do that, so I don't think it's going to get a lot of awards attention from the big awards groups. Now the independent groups they're more likely to honor it.
Well, John Wirt, another journalistic luminary in the class with John, Mike Wallace, 93, died in 2012 on April 7th. 60 Minutes, that show. I remember the first. Edition.
Episode.
That was, what are you calling it?
Would you call it an episode?
I don't know. That doesn't sound right for 60 Minutes, but I think it was in September of 1968. Richard Nixon was the first profile, and Mike Wallace conducted the interview, and Nixon tried to hire Wallace as his press secretary, unsuccessfully. How Wallace's life would have changed had he been the press secretary for Dick Nixon.
Wallace was a newsman. When he died, they had all the retrospectives and the appreciations, and you saw what a devoted, dogged, aggressive reporter he was, and he seemed to be fearless, which I admire a lot, because I'm not fearless, and I'm really a shy person. But what I like about the news business is that it brings me into the world.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757 for John Wirt of The Advocate. Thomas and Walden, good morning to you. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning, and thanks to John for his reviews of the movies. A lot of us who are moviegoers depend a lot on what he thinks of the movie, and my question had to do with why does he think the Tribune people dropped a bomb on Les Miserables, which would help acquaint a lot of people with Victor Hugo. And why was he so excited about Barbara Streisand? Thanks a lot.
You're probably talking about, thank you for your comment, by the way, and you're probably talking about Tribune. We run the film clips from Tribune in our fun section, and I don't remember the content of that capsule review exactly right now. Can you find it, Jim?
I'm looking for
you
it.
You could even, Les Miserables, L. Look for L.
That, yes.
Of course. Because they're in alphabetical order.
Yeah.
Some people have really, some other critics, major critics, have hated Les Miserables. They've just despised
it. 1.5 stars.
1.5 stars from the Tribune Media.
Mm-hmm.
You want to read it?
It says, the film version of the popular French Revolution musical is destined for Oscar nods. That being said, it doesn't exactly work. Hugh Jackman has the chops to sing. Anne Hathaway takes a turn as Fantine and nails her one song. Otherwise, director Tom Hooper fumbles with a few numbers, moves his camera far too much, and relies on Russell Crowe, who can't really pull off the singing. It's just all right. 1.5 stars, though. That's what you usually give for a bomb.
I would have, that review reads like it would be maybe 2.5 stars.
Yeah, but it got 1.5. Mm. Lincoln got 4 stars.
Right.
Did you like Lincoln?
Lincoln is a great historical movie. One of the great things about it, of course, is Daniel Day-Lewis in the role of Lincoln. And I had the, I don't like to say honor or privilege or whatever, because I'm a professional, but I got to speak with Tony Kirshner, who wrote the screenplay for Lincoln. And he talked about how great Daniel Day-Lewis was, and that he and Steven Spielberg, the movie's director, thought, if we can't get Daniel Day-Lewis to play it, if he won't do it, we don't know if we have a movie, because we're so confident, we're so sure that Daniel Day-Lewis is the right person for the role, that we may just stop the whole project if he doesn't sign on. And they said it took a bit of courting to get him to come into the role. But he looks, physically, he looks so much like Lincoln, and the voice that he has on screen sounds so much like it could be Lincoln, and it's amazing. It's probably going to win an Oscar for Daniel Day-Lewis for Best Actor and multiple other awards, Golden Globes and on and on. And this film will be up for many more nominations for a screenplay for Tony Kirshner, Spielberg for director. And then in the supporting cast, you have Tommy Lee Jones in a classic Tommy Lee Jones performance. So this is, and I want to say something about Lincoln. Lincoln was shot in Richmond, Virginia, my hometown, and I think it was shot in nearby Petersburg, where there was a famous Civil War, horrible, devastating battle in Petersburg.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look in the White House scenes, you'll see wallpaper in the White House office where Lincoln meets with his cabinet and so on. I have to tell you that my nephew printed the wallpaper.
Really?
He was working in Richmond, Virginia at a printer company, a printing company, and one of the things this printing company does is historic wallpaper. So my nephew is a graphic designer. He didn't design it. I think the owner of the company designed it, modeled after photographs from the White House during the Civil mm-hmm. War.
Well, I did want to note that 50 years ago today, the Beatles had their attempt to get a contract with Decca Records turned down, famous audition. And here is one of the songs from that session, January 1, 1962.
Tent of green, and half the salt, the shine.
the Sheikh of Araby. They weren't singing about Araby, Louisiana, either. And John, it reminds me occasionally that I'm behind the times. In this case, if it was 1962, this is 2013. It was 51 years. I thought we had a momentous anniversary here. 51's a good number, though.
If I was a Decca Records executive and I heard this, what you just played, I think I'd be inclined to turn them down, too, because that's not that good. Let's be honest. All right, for one thing, George Harrison is on the lead vocals. Mm-hmm. For another thing, that's not an original Beatles song.
No.
So the Beatles were still developing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that's not a great cut.
Well, and it was turned down, much to the chagrin of the folks at Decca Records. Now, around that time, a gentleman named Bill Cosby became the first African-American performer on network television in a major role with I Spy. And you talk about people I interviewed. I've never interviewed Bill Cosby, but John Wirt did.
I want to say that I did not interview Bill. I let Bill talk, and I listened.
Yes.
Okay, because I had prepared for hours, because it's Bill Cosby, the great Bill Cosby, a legend of comedy, a legend of television, all these things. And all of us, many of us grew up with Bill Cosby. And I know Jim and I watched the show that he had on NBC before he had his famous sitcom. Mm-hmm. And
Chet Kincaid. he was a coach.
The coach in the high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good little program, I thought.
He's 75 years old, I believe, and he put on a tremendous
for 2 hours
performance.
Well, what happened when I interviewed him, I had all my questions mm-hmm. ready, and I thought I wanted them to be good questions. I worked hard to get them ready. So I asked him a question, but he riffs for a half hour on one question. He's just such a genius. You know, he loves jazz music, and so like a mm-hmm. great jazz musician, he can riff, he can improvise. And he has amazing imagination.
All right. Well, Kelly asks about the symphony, and next month Diana Ross will be performing with the symphony. Diana is 68 years old now and still in her prime, which has lasted for some time. She was singing about the time the Beatles were doing the Sheikh of Araby. She'd been around for a long time. We're looking forward to that one, John.
She got right. They're contemporaries. How old is she? She's 68.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Paul McCartney is he 71? 70?
I think so. 70.
They're right about the same age, and there's a famous, often seen photograph of the Beatles with the Supremes. It's a very nice photo. Or maybe it's just Paul McCartney with the Supremes. Could be.
Well, this Diana Ross will be with Tim Muffin. Should be quite a combo in the Baton Rouge Symphony, and I would think this will be something that we were talking about at the end of 2013.
I want to tell you that I was not a great fan of last year's Natalie Cole concert with the symphony. These are big names, and they're well-known, and they were famous, but
didn't do it for John. We'll be back after this one-and-a-half-minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we thank John Wirt for joining us and providing his insight into what's happening in the entertainment world. And his work appears every Friday in the fun section of The Advocate and other days as well when he's reviewing performances of note in our community. Last night, the fiscal cliff was averted, and taxes will not increase for most Americans. President Obama reelected by a margin of almost 5 million votes. That was the big story of 2012. And as we talk about politics in the past year and politics over the years in which yours truly has been conducting a talk show, one of the untold stories, that unreported stories, maybe John Wirt would be the person to write something about callers to talk shows and how they can influence policy and personalities and elections. And one of the most prominent callers in the history of talk radio in Louisiana, formerly Elwood in New Orleans, now Elwood in Atlanta, is a gentleman whose given name is David C. Bellinger, who celebrated his 64th birthday a few days ago on Christmas Day. And Elwood was born in the French Quarter. Grew up
half
in the
a block from Bourbon Street and Little Italy in the lower quarter, Jim.
And he has been tormenting newsmakers for years. When they hear his voice, they want to run for the hills sometimes. Good morning, Elwood.
Good morning. Happy New Year to you and your listeners. And, Jim, I want to say one thing up front. I have never done anything to intimidate, harass, or talk hosts or a station in my life before they harassed and intimidated me. And I never gave anyone any reason of any kind to ever ban me from a talk show. But, Jim, people are afraid of the truth, particularly on conservative talk radio, and I stand behind that statement. And I give you many examples of that as we go on.
Well, you're a person who occasionally gets into talk shows that they don't want you to be a part of. I suppose when you call in, you don't say you're Elwood.
Well, I've been using, on many talk shows, I have to make up a name because most stations that I call, they recognize me, and I have to get someone to stay on the phone and go through the screening process or they won't take my call. Jim, I'll give you an example. When I came to Atlanta after Katrina, Herman Cain was filling in on a talk show in Atlanta, and he said the only thing President Clinton did as president was raise taxes. I called in to say you've given out incorrect information. President Clinton in 1995 signed the Holy Grail Republican Party, a capital gains tax cut that reduced the effective tax rate for the 400 wealthiest individual American taxpayers from 30% to 22%. Herman Cain, who I call the House Negro of the Republican Party and the Tea Party, he said, I've never heard of that, and I don't think you know what you're talking about. From that point on, and I sent emailed the information to Herman Cain, from that point on, when I called in under the name of Elwood, Herman would not take my phone call.
Well, shame on Herman.
By the way, he was filling in again last week at that same station in Atlanta, in the call screen, and wanted to know what I wanted to say to Herman. And I said, well, I want to find out, since he gave up the campaign to be president, has he had a chance to put a move on any white women lately to get a piece of leg and offering them a job?
Well,
and the lady said that I was going to be reported to the security. And evidently, the Herman Cain security people haven't come taking me away yet, Jim, but I guess I should be concerned, don't you think?
Well, I could understand their concerns about talking about Mr. Cain's sex life. That's what unraveled his presidential aspirations, and he is now once again a talk show host, in which we're more forgiving of talk show hosts than their offenses, as we know with Rush Hudson Limbaugh III. Here's a man who has had his problems with drug addiction and four marriages and was a draft dodger and go on and on, college dropout, but yet he is on the air and revered by many people who are probably far more intelligent than he, but he does a good show. He's an extremely talented man, Elwood, and you must, despite your liberal credentials, you must find some edification to listen to all these conservatives on the air.
I don't listen as much as you think, Jim. I can't handle most of it, but I do like to call and give out some honest facts. You know, the first time we met, you had Larry Nichols on your program, who I call a professional Clinton hater from Arkansas, and I could never call Larry Nichols because he appeared on a Keith Rush show in New Orleans, and Keith banned me a long time ago from his show, and a friend called and said, well, Larry Nichols is on with Jim Inkstra. This goes back probably more than 10 years, Jim.
That's 15 years
ago.
So
I called your program. It was the first time I ever called, and I told Larry Nichols that he was a liar. He told Keith Rush that Hillary was indicted. He was the only person who knew it because he had a source inside the Justice Department. And then it quickly turned into a shouting and name-calling match. And then shortly after that, Larry walked off the interview, and I said to myself, this was my first phone call to Jim Inkster, and it'll be my last. But, Jim, you not only took my phone calls, you had me on as a guest. So I salute you for that, and I did nothing but speak the truth, Jim.
Well, I'm having you on as a guest again, and as I say, Elwood is one of a few people in the state who call shows who I think are probably better known than many of the hosts of the shows that they're calling in on because they are ubiquitous in their presence on the dial. And Elwood for years has called Senator David Vitter, who used to be a regular guest of mine and other talk show hosts, and since 2007, Senator Vitter has pretty much shut it down. In fact, he After 2002, he quit doing a lot of talk shows after Vincent Bruno was on a show with me and stated 5 years before the story broke that David Vitter was involved with prostitutes. Now, then something happened then involving you. What transpired at that point, Elwood, in 2002 when the first revelation?
Well, in 2002, you know, I know Vincent Bruno. Vincent Bruno is a friend of mine, and I have the absolute total respect for Vincent Bruno's integrity. Vincent Bruno's a conservative Republican. I'm a liberal Democrat. We're very dear friends, and I revere the man for his integrity. Now, I know Vincent Bruno, and I had no doubt what Vincent Bruno told you was the truth regarding David Vitter having an affair with a French Quarter prostitute, allegedly Wendy Cortez. Well, shortly after, in 2002, when Vincent made that remark on your program regarding Vitter's moral failing with a prostitute, Vitter, on July 25th, was on a New Orleans talk station, and I called in and challenged him, and my phone call was played on national television for Larry Flint of Hustler Magazine and Wendy Cortez. And if people go to YouTube and look for Congressman Accidentally Admits to Affair with Call Girl, or read my column, the May 22nd, 2010 column at righthandthief.blogspot.com, there's a link to the YouTube video where my phone call was played on national television. I challenged David Vitter to sign an affidavit he never knew, met, or been in the company of Wendy Cortez or had sex outside of his marriage. And he went on to say those rumors are absolutely true. And then he went on to attack his accusers. Now, people could read much more about that in my column.
Well, he obviously meant to say those rumors are absolutely untrue, but he did say that they're absolutely true. Maybe a Freudian slip. But Senator Vitter, I think largely because of Elwood, avoids most talk shows. And recently, he was doing a show on a small station in New Orleans, and lo and behold, Elwood pops up. How did that happen? How did you get through?
Well, ironically, I'm on the email list of the talk host, and he's a conservative, but he likes me to call his program, and he was kind and generous enough to give me a heads up that Vitter was going to be on, and I think Vitter, likely having avoided talk radio for years, likely because of me. I was the first caller, probably the last person he wanted to talk to, and I have the phone call on tape, and it's not good quality. But, Jim, could I tell you a really funny story? In 2004, David Vitter was on a New Orleans crime program hosted by a Plaquemine Parish Sheriff's Major John Marie. Jim Letton was the guest, and David Vitter was the guest. So I called in. And John Marie knows me from talk radio, and he's a conservative, but bless him, he lets me talk. So I wanted to talk to David Vitter regarding his alleged involvement with Wendy Cortez. Well, when Vitter heard I was on hold, Vitter excused himself to make a phone call. So the host, John Marie, said that Congressman Vitter, he said he had to make a phone call. So do you want to talk to Jim Letton? And I talked to Jim Letton about the Bush campaign allegedly importing T-shirts from Burma illegally. And then John Marie said, are you finished? And I said, yes, but John Marie kept my phone line open. And then Vitter came back into the interview with no idea I was on hold. And then I challenged him to sign an affidavit again. And Chris Tidmore wrote about the incident. And much of that column is discussed in my column, the May 22nd, right, 2010 column. But I think, you know, I'm totally blind. I use a talking computer, but I wish I could have been in the studio to see David Vitter's face when he found out my phone line was still open. So I am the only person who's had three challenges to David Vitter live on talk radio.
All right, and people will ask things as callers, as Elwood does, that journalists often will not ask. And one of the reasons journalists will not ask is because they know they will encounter people like Senator Vitter again and again and again, and it's not a good idea usually as a journalist to get shut out from access. But Elwood is a brave man, and you started your odyssey in New Orleans as a union person, correct?
I am proud to say I was an AFL-CIO union shop steward for the Office and Professional Employees International for the largest, at the time, the largest containerized steamship company in New Orleans. I never lost a grievance, never lost a worker. An election took a penny from my union, and I had the local president and secretary treasurer removed for ethical reasons. I could have been, perhaps I put my health and safety in jeopardy doing that, and I never took a penny from the union, and I'm very proud of the people I represented, and I'm a strong labor person, Jim, and that was a great honor to represent working people for the largest containerized steamship company in New Orleans.
297-5633 in our remaining moments with David C. Bellinger, better known as Elwood, in Atlanta. Phil in Jefferson Terrace, one of those callers who often makes a difference. Phil, good morning. You're on the air with Elwood.
Good morning, gentlemen. Happy New Year to y'all. And just to extend my thanks, I'm sure a lot of other people, to you and your staff, Jim. My question is, on the D.C. Madam scandal, wasn't that woman like let out, hung out to dry in that court case and ended up committing suicide?
The D.C. Madam, thank you, Phil. The D.C. Madam case, the woman did commit suicide, didn't she, Elwood?
Yes, she did. She hanged herself, unfortunately. Jim, could I tell you a quick story?
Well, we've got some folks waiting to talk with you, Elwood.
I have to be back another time because I have so many stories to tell, Jim.
I did want to note that the newsmakers who are on friendly terms with Elwood often converse with him and email and otherwise. And one of those, I've heard it since, but I think you're the first person who told me that Edwin Edwards will be 86 on August 7th. 22 days after that, his wife is now expecting a baby.
Well, yes, he is. That's what I was told, Jim.
So Edwin Washington Edwards, if everything goes according to plan, will have a baby on August 29th, which is the anniversary of Katrina, and his wife is named Trina. So Trina will be giving birth on the anniversary of Katrina. And Edwin Edwards, this would mean he would be 104 when his child graduates from high school, Elwood.
If anybody, he'll be eligible to run for governor again.
If anybody can pull it off, I think that Edwin Edwards probably could. Dorothy in Goodwood. Dorothy, good morning. You're on with Elwood. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi, Elwood. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask if you have ever found any correlation between the suicides of the D.C. Madam and the suicide of Sylvia Landry.
All right. Sylvia Landry was a prostitute in Baton Rouge who also took her life, and I know of no correlation between those two. And
D.C. Madam did say on national radio on Coast to Coast she would commit suicide if she were convicted.
Well, people who are in that line of work probably have some challenges that would result in depression. And
Jim, one of the women that David Vitter had sent to his Washington apartment was a woman that was moonlighting as a call girl for Deborah Jean Palfrey, the D.C. Madam, and she showed up at Vitter's apartment, and evidently they recognized each other because they both worked on the same committee when Vitter was a congressman.
Well, David Vitter was no doubt up to what some might say no good in his days as a congressman, but this story is now an old story, and there have been no new revelations since it was revealed in 2007 that he was on the list. And by the way, it was an intrepid reporter who traced all the call numbers and found Senator Vitter's number.
Dan Moldavia, a man I know personally.
Yeah, and why should this be relevant today? Why can't we give the senator a break unless something new happens, Elwood? This is an old story.
Well, let me tell you, Whitewater was an old story that was investigated three independent times before President Clinton took office, and they spent $80 million on a special prosecutor.
Well, do two wrongs make a right? Just because Whitewater was a fiasco, or should we continue to hound Senator Vitter about something that happened more than 5 years ago?
If he violated the law, which I believe he did, I think the people have a right to know, and Vitter should have some type of obligation to answer. Even the governor of South Carolina, Sanford. I mean, he admitted to his affair with an Argentina woman. I mean, he confessed what he said. I mean, what he did. The governor of New York, the Democratic governor, resigned, and he confessed. Wiener confessed and resigned. And I don't know of one Republican who called for Wiener and the governor of New York to resign. But they won't say a word about Vitter.
Well, Vitter has not been inclined to talk about it, and to this point he has won an election without talking about this incident. And at this point, unless something new happens, it is an old story. And I would be inclined, Elwood, you and I agree on many things, but I would be inclined at this point to say let's move on to other topics with Senator Vitter unless something happens of a contemporary nature on this level. But nothing that I know of going on right now with the senator as far as any involvement with prostitutes. Richard Fisher says we got to go. Elwood, thank you so much. Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year to everybody who's listening. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.